Good morning, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearing. And if that gives the Valley Station a little bit. Parker.
Good morning, Commissioners. Good morning, sir. Thank you for that. You will speedily assemble our team to come and present to you today. I'm very conscious as council of your minutes of, I think, the 8th of April, which encouraged council not to take up all the usable time that was given to a submitter. And much as I would like to think that I could engage your attention for 6 hours, you'll be relieved to know that I'm not going to attempt that. All right.
I should say it wasn't directed at you. It was directed at other council who had done that.
I thought I would provide you with that comfort right at the beginning in any event. You've seen that my client, Chief Operating Officer Mr. Hunt, and my colleagues have put up on the wall plans with at least some of which you will be familiar with, but you'll be become familiar with them as the day goes on. The top left-hand one is the structure plan, and I think you may be at least somewhat familiar with that. I understand from Mr. Hunt that when you commissioners visited the site, that you were providing a copy of that. You'll be aware also that I provided another copy with my legal submissions, and the extra inclusion there was that table you can see bottom left-hand corner, which we hope is of some assistance to you in relation to building coverage. So hopefully you're familiar with that. You may also be with the top right-hand master plan, and then there are some visuals to assist you, which hopefully you'll have time to spend upon as they emerge through the evidence. I would like to hand up, if I may, to you immediately to assist you. And again, I'm not going to provide you with a snowstorm of paper, but this provides you with 2 pages of comparison tables. And the first table shows you the consented activities as they exist, but in the context of the structure plan. You'll see over on the left of that table the particular resource consent, where it was granted, what was the activity consent, and then over on the right-hand side, identifying the activity areas within which those would occur. And then on the next page, you have consented activities compared with the zoning provisions, particularly in relation to the units, residential units, work accommodation, and that sort of thing. You'll notice at the bottom of table 2 there's reference to the rockery, but of course that is not part of the proposed subzone, but it is part of the consent that was put in place in 2008.
Just an immediate question, this brings to mind on table 1, you've got there the year the consents were granted. Are these all implemented consents, or have some of these lapsed?
Some of them have lapsed, I believe, but others have been implemented. It might be best to let me address by Mr. Hunt. In particular, that's how we envisage we might proceed. If that's acceptable to you, sir.
Yes.
Thank you. Hopefully you'll find that of some use. I can just address a number of matters preparatory to any questions you may have of me. And some of them are minor. Others are more substantial, certainly in the eyes of my clients. In the legal submissions put forward by the council in response to the submission and evidence and my submissions, there's reference to an outline development plan that had been put forward. That was a long time ago, right at the beginning of the process, and that very rapidly became a structure plan as a result of an engagement between my client and the council, in particular one of the defendants, Mr. Barr, and that's how the matter has evolved to the point where we see the structure plan before you. So whilst there was historically an outline development plan, it very quickly evolved into one where the structure plan was more appropriate, giving more detail and assurance, I think, to council, and that's the way the matter has progressed. There was criticism in the QLDC's legal submissions that there had been a provision of an amended structure plan, which I've already referred to. I don't believe that was in any way appropriate. I'd like to think it was of assistance to the panel. It was something that was already with you, as far as I understand, and the only enhancement is that table, which I referred to. The other material was that there was some other material that came in by way of the rules, which had been refined by Mr. Gittins. Again, this was evidence that was before the commissioners, I would suggest, and a refinement, I suggest, is also appropriate and in accordance with the relatively informal mode in which these hearings are held, which is not to deprecate them in any way. In fact, it does seem to enhance this process, which is robust and pragmatic. And I hope if there's any concern about that, the commissioners will address me upon it so that I can respond. But I believe that the material that came in with my submissions was simply a refinement of something that was before you already. And rather than wait till today to present to you material that arose as a result of rebuttal evidence, it was with you in that way for consideration. If you have time in your busy schedule to have reviewed, we do appreciate how fortunate we are being with you on Monday, but it does give you some respite from hearings to recover from the previous week and perhaps address some of the material we've provided. The other benefit we suggest in having that material accompany my submission gave an opportunity for pertinent commentary from QLDC's lead advisor and the planning advisors. There is a great deal of benefit in that. You will have noticed that between my legal submissions, there was no further opportunity after our primary evidence had gone in for anything to be said further. If there had been no material supplied with my legal submissions, I suggest Dr. Reed would not have got to the point of readdressing this matter. You may recall in her primary evidence, she was not comfortable with this proposal and opposed it. She received and considered our evidence in chief, and whilst her position has softened in her rebuttal evidence, it was still the position that she did not feel that she could give this proposal her imprimatur. Mm-hmm. However, by the time she came to issue her summary on the 21st of July, she had completely changed her position and felt that all her concerns had been met, and of course the changes that had occurred since her rebuttal evidence and that summary was the legal submission and the material that accompanied it. So there does seem to have been a real benefit which could have been missed had it not been made available. In my submission also, the materials that accompanied my submissions were well within the scope of the submission. These latter aspects bring me to a point which I have to convey to you has troubled my clients. Both the recent submission from the council's legal advisor and the planner omitted to say that Dr. Reed had changed her position. In fact, they both say the opposite. which is of concern to my clients, as you can imagine. It is possible that the legal advisor and the planner were not aware of her change of position. That would seem extraordinary to me, but these things do happen. So one assumes the most benign outcome. But it is concerning because we did our best to listen to the recording of the 25th of July, which is when this matter was discussed between the panel and Mr. Buxton, and we could not discern from the recording, which was quite challenging at times because someone had a bit of a cough that day, that the planner was aware or even brought to your attention that Dr. Reed had changed her position, although I acknowledge that Dr. Reed was here, but the recording is not terribly clear, so the commissioners, you will know what you heard on that day. But from my client's point of view, I am labouring this because they feel that it's such a significant aspect, the landscape context of their submission, that this should have been very clearly brought to the panel's attention. In any event, no supplementary submission from the lawyer or supplementary submission from the planner has come in to you to correct the wrong impression that is in both their materials that came into you most recently. As a final minor point, sir, you will recall that at the end of my submissions I did raise with you the evidence of Ms. Kim Banks, whereby she assessed NPS UDC and seemed to include Gibson Valley within that process. You'll recall I put in a short memorandum about this. I think it's an error by Ms. Banks. I don't think she intended to include Gibson in that assessment, and it appears from Ms. Scott's legal submission on behalf of the council that she accepted that may be the case as well. I don't think we need to dwell on that. I'd like to think the commissioners would agree with that, but it does seem anomalous. As you will have anticipated, there are a number of witnesses to be heard by you. No doubt you've had some opportunity to review primary evidence of my client's expert witnesses. There are a number of them here today to speak to summaries of their evidence, which we hope will bring back to the top of the mind what they said in their primary evidence. There's one substitution. Mr. Keyes, who is the Gibson Valley Station winemaker, is unable to be here, but he is being substituted by Ms. Sasha Herbert, who is also a winemaker for the station, who can provide a summary and speak to what is in Mr. Keyes' primary evidence. The evidence you will hear would be in this order. Firstly, Mr. Brett Giddens, who is my client's planning advisor, who sits to my right and will be known to you. Ms. Herbert, whom I just referred to. Mr. Milne, landscape architect. Mr. Carr, traffic engineer. Mr. Gume, who's coming a little later in the morning as we try to time his arrival. Finally, Mr. Hunt, who is the CEO of Gibson Valley Station Limited. So, those were all the matters I wanted to cover in my opening. I am, of course, available to be questioned by the commissioners preparatory to calling that evidence before you.
I'm just wondering why we're not hearing from Ms. Sneaton.
I think it was cited that Mr. Milne should be here. Ms. Neatham worked very closely, or I know that she and Mr. Milne worked very closely on this matter, and it was a matter of availability and timing, and I hope that will not be of any detriment. Mr. Milne obviously is one of the principals of his firm, very experienced in this geographical area. So if there's any concern about that, we can address it later.
Have we had evidence from Mr. Milne?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I've missed it.
No, sorry, did you say is there any evidence, Mr. Milne? No. He's addressing Ms. Sneedon's evidence. And he does have a summary of his own.
Okay. Any questions? I just leave you some little elders here. Only one, because in fact your legal submissions aren't dealing extensively with the law, are they? Your legal submissions aren't you haven't actually dealt extensively with the law. You've given us a lot of background information.
I probably have, and I accept that's valid.
That wasn't the question anyway, it was just a question.
But yes.
So in your paragraph 43, it was just that point about views from the Kawamau River. Lack of assessment from effects from the river. It's always an interesting question as to when you deal with detailed effect, whether you have to, how far you go at zoning stage compared to the resource consent. But there does need to be some filter applied at the zoning stage to give the panel confidence that we wouldn't be completely wasting our time if we go further.
Yes.
If you understand what I'm saying.
I do. I accept that. This was something raised by Dr. Reed, as I say, that among other things seems to have been addressed, but the views, that criticism does not appear to have been based upon something Dr. Reed has herself assessed. The reason for my, I hope, not dismissive comment there, is that she did not seem to have based it upon any particular assessment herself. And I don't recall that she referred back in any way to that being a concern in relation to the 2008 resource consent. Although I acknowledge that I think in relation to this view, she was talking about activity area 2, in which there will be more activity than was the case then. But I believe Mr. Milne is in a position to respond to that so the commissioners can get to that point, sir, of giving you some insight, some comfort that you require at this stage.
Yeah. That's more important than not to read Dr. Wesley did or didn't get to, just that you will address it.
Yes.
It's a follow-up question, and it's about the kind of analysis that needs to be done to satisfy an assessment of effects on ONL. I'll put the situation to you and you can answer. The Gibson character zone is specifically excluded from the ONL, but the ONL surrounds it. And the planner's note 5 refers to an assessment of, and I forgot the exact word, but it appears to say that you need to consider in zoning or in consent the effects on the ONL anyway. So what I want to know is the assessment of landscape effects confined to the Gibson character zone, or should it include effects of the, shall we say, the ratcheting up or the ratcheting down of the development potential on the O&L, within that zone on the O&L?
My view is, and this is also it's a legal planning question, I suppose, but my view would be that it's the effect of the zone rather than what we say is that we're proposing a subzone within that character zone, therefore the effects of the existing character zone must be assessed on the O&L.
So that must mean that the effects of the subzone have to be assessed on the
I think that's right. It would not be reasonable otherwise.
You assess the effects of the subzone on the O&L, as well as on the Gibson character zone?
No, it's part of it. As the subzone is, I think the word Mr. Gibson has used is subset of the Gibson character zone, therefore you see it as one for the purpose of assessing its effect on O&L, but of course it's more properly dealt with, and I will defer to him to respond in a moment on this, dealt with at resource consent stage.
Yeah, on that point, with it being a subset of the Gibson character zone, all the key assessment criteria and land factor assessment criteria relating to O&Ls, and when it comes to Gibson, it's generally relating to O&Ls, sites that are joining outstanding natural landscapes, because there are no outstanding natural landscapes within the Gibson character zone. So all that assessment criteria remains as is. So when there's a resource consent applied for, that's a consideration at the time that they have to be undertaken as part of the discretion of the non-compliant resource consent application in that subset still.
What consideration then is given for all the controlled activities that you're proposing?
In terms of landscape and O&L? Well, that's where we've got to with that, is that if it's a controlled activity that's appropriate within that site and context, and that's where the landscape evidence design standard supports a federal development within the Gibson subset of the Gibson character zone.
And if there was any suggestion, well, I'm not saying there is, that the Gibson character zone itself isn't doing an adequate job in dealing with effects on the O&L, then is it appropriate to go higher and go beyond? Have we got a King Salmon exception?
I think so. There'd have to be some basis for your primary contention.
I know. I'm aware of that.
Then what speculation on speculation may not be a great business here. Without being disrespectful, that's what I'm trying to say.
I wanted to make a comment. It was a bit of a struggle following the moving feet. So if Mr. Giddens would walk us through step by step the proposition today, I'd be grateful.
If you were aware of that, being the position the Commission might be in, so we're very alive to that and would like to put that in mind.
Just before Mr. Giddens does that, Mr. Parker, just in paragraph 68, you talk about it's important that planting and various plantings go ahead first. How is it envisaged that that occur?
Sorry, I am going to ask Mr. Giddens to address that.
I'd like to clarify that and answer. The matters of control and discretion have landscaping as one of the requirements. There's nothing specific there that requires that those planting areas be undertaken first. I believe that the viticultural evidence clarifies that infrastructure has been put in for that in 2018, but instead. But that has actually been a point that we've discussed internally about potentially the woodhead verification control that would require that landscaping to go on first, because we have put some degree of reliance on that as part of mitigation and also trying to achieve the overall purpose of the zone as it stands currently.
And Mr. Hunt also can address that.
Thank you.
Okay, just to remember, thank you.
Just refer to one of my attachments, because I do appreciate that this has been sort of a moving piece in terms of the process that we've started to, we've got to. And one of the documents that's going to be referred to is my Pilgrim's feed. I actually pitched this last week, more for instance, one person than the other person, just to get a good dispatch of what we can do within each of the activity areas. So should we look at the question that both that supersedes planning decisions, it's more of a again an overview. So if you look at activity area one, for instance, or activity area two, we will outline what activities can we undertake in the zone, what the resource consists of space for, and it looks at it in the context of the sub zone as well as the existing provisions of the existing character zone that's got to be retained. So that's a mark appendix B, which you'll have there at the time, gives them daily sub zone activity period evaluation summary. My name is Bruce Evans, and my qualifications and experience are detailed and later in the sheet of paper from June 2017. This summary sets out key points of my evidence, and I've also written the rebuttal evidence to Mr. Robert Buxton on behalf of the council, and I've responded to his comments. Gibson Valley Station says she is only a part of the land located on Gibson Highway to provide for a range of uses, including viticulture, horticulture, residential, commercial recreation, and visitor accommodation. The proposal is principally in advance as a sub-zone within the physical character zone, rather than a new zone or replication of an existing zone. I consider that any of the planning provisions for the physical character zone are important in the context of the locale. And in my opinion, taking this approach ensures that the overall intent of the fictional characters is upheld. I've considered this in my Section 32 evaluation, and I know that no issues being raised from council with this approach. The subzones generally set around the confines of previously approved resource consent with more specific assessment of the subzone undertaken by the system of education experts as part of this process. The resource consent is useful in a contextual setting of what development can occur in the locality. I do not consider it helpful to analyse the consent process in detail. While some of the landscape concerns were finally balanced at that time, the council found it appropriate to approve consent and forms part of the environment that I've considered evaluating the proposals. This is a zone change request under a proposed plan, a document that might reflect the evolution and reasonable future evolution of development in the district, whereas the resource consent is essentially a snapshot in time. The Gibson Valley proposal was informed by discussion with council staff after the initial submission and has been more recently clarified to address concerns raised in council evidence. I've noticed that clarity has been provided around the entities and types of activity to occur within the subset. In my experience, being involved with numerous proposals from Gibson Character Zone, the key planning issues I've encountered in the landscape focus, with transportation being a key secondary issue. Dr. Reed for the council is satisfied with the proposal from the landscape perspective. Mr. Mander appears relatively satisfied on traffic matters, and Mr. Davis and Mr. Glasner are satisfied with the ecological infrastructure range respectively. So turning to the planning matters, Mr. Buxton recommends that the proposal be rejected, and I quote, "If the proposed zone would significantly increase the visitor, residential, commercial development that has been consent found in the Gibson Character Zone, and would erode the sense of character of the Gibson Valley, which is rural and based around agriculture." His primary issue appears to be density and site coverage, as well as the reliance placed on the approved resource consent. I note that the Gibson Character Zone is not set at density or a minimum allotment size for subdivision, rather there is a reliance on discretionary consideration. I do not entirely follow Mr. Buxton's site coverage calculations set out in the summary, as they have not appeared to relate to the planning provisions put forth. And again, I refer to the panel to my proposed planning provision for structure plan that detail the proposed activities within each activity area and the respective consenting requirements and the controls of density and coverage within each activity area. In my opinion, the proposal should not be looked at in isolation to the mitigating benefits that the productive planting areas will provide. These areas have been specifically identified to also help give effect to some of the existing policies of the Gibson Character Zone relating to viticulture, productive land uses, and similarly the commercial activity rules outside of AA4, which is the business village, have been amended to relate to uses ancillary to wiring viticultural activity for a similar purpose. In my opinion, the panel needs to be satisfied that the rules framework provides for an adequate secondary assessment via the subsequent resource consent process that will follow. In my opinion, this has been achieved. The queries raised by Mr. Buxton in regard to needing an updated natural hazard assessment are addressed by Mr. Gourmet. I've also updated the matters of control and discretion to include natural hazards as a balance of braces approach to the provisions. As set out in Section 32 evaluation appended to my evidence, I consider that the establishment of a subzone of the existing Gibson Character Zone, along with the provisions and rules, to be a more efficient and effective method of achieving sustainable management than the provisions in the proposed district plan relating to the Gibson Character Zone. In my opinion, the proposed subzone enables appropriate development to occur within the Gibson Character Zone and is appropriate for inclusion within the proposed district plan. Yes.
Shall I just ask you?
Yes.
Just to check the facts here, but the plan up there is the one we're relying on?
Yes, correct.
Is the golf course out?
The golf course?
Because it's in and out depending who you read.
Yeah, the golf course is consented under the 2008 consent. It's a permitted activity under the operative planning rules and the proposed planning rules. It's been put on that plan essentially for clarity of what's been there. Mr. Hunt may well comment on that shortly as to whether it's likely that that's going to occur or not.
So it's been consented and it can happen.
It can happen.
Is it going to be authorised if the zoning subzone is approved? Will it be authorised as an activity or will it be ignored?
No, it would be permitted in any case.
Okay. Right. the concert area in Oran. So then I think in the patent submission was
Yeah, so
it was helpful. I got
points there.
Yes,
so. Just before you do that, I just want to follow up on the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
On what basis are you saying it's permitted in the proposed plan?
The commercial recreation activity was no greater than 10 people per group, which would, and if it exceeds 10 people per group, it would require a consent.
So you're
the
saying that
my golf, most people don't use it more than 10 group.
So it's a poor definition of commercial recreation, because I don't think that was the intention. I would have thought that more than 10 people are playing golf, that you've got a group of more than 10.
I think the number of consent processes with this definition, including in the Gibson Carriage Zone, and it's a requirement of both the Gibson Carriage Zone and the Rural General Zone, and it is a relatively loose definition. If you've got
I wouldn't say numbers, but just loose.
if you've got a number of groups within one activity, if you're no greater than that number within the activity, that is the threshold. So, I don't think it's, you are pretty loose.
So
back to
the
concept.
Area. In
order. So, as part of the proposal, the prior structure plan had that area marked as the concert site, and then with the later transition of it, this area here was removed to try and create balance between the two residential development areas. So in effect, this area here was already consented for development, which was a 42-unit visitor accommodation complex. So removing the built form here effectively gets the value made the decision to retain the built form there. So effectively, until that site's developed, provided there's a zone approved, the Gibson concert site will remain, but when it's developed, it obviously has to be either moved or discontinued.
So I'll go back the other way and say yes, the concert place stays.
Sorry, I know it's not correctly presented. I can probably answer this question first, but you'll be away for I think answer from that.
It's not formed to a provision, but it doesn't.
So that's why I'm confused about the proposal. Because there's what's consented, what's in the provision, what's on the plan, differences in evidence. I need to be clear. So the concert basin is consented?
Correct.
But isn't part of the provision.
When does the existing consent expire?
Yeah. It had 10-year consent.
When does the existing consent expire?
15-year consent granted in 2008.
2023.
Okay. That's my main
factual stuff sorted. I'm So just more factual stuff. If we go to 8.12 on your primary evidence, where you've got the outlining the development scenario.
8.12?
Yes, on page 13 and 14. So, the 90 rooms for staff accommodation, so presumably this operation doesn't have 90 staff.
So just to clarify, 8.11, 8.12, that's a development scenario that was looked at by Mr. Carp on the traffic.
Yeah.
Just on that perspective. The 90 rooms are projecting something just a 100 clarified in terms of staff numbers and the like, but from my understanding, it's a bit difficult from the timing of picking cracks and the like. They had a lot of staff that come to the Eastern Valley to pick cracks and send to the vines.
I take it that the provisions as written provide no limit on the number of rooms for workers' accommodation.
There's one location, which is A88 for workers' accommodation, which is a maximum of 90 rooms. And above that, the treasurer can set requirement for.
Where is it in the rules that it says it's a maximum of 90 rooms?
Mike from the Health of Group referred to one thing today.
Oh, I see.
It's 23.52 workers' accommodation activity area AMS greater than 90 rooms. So that's true of the discretionary activity.
So we can take the 90 rooms that's given then because it's a controlled activity up to that level.
Correct.
The next slide, 3,000 square metres of gross floor area commercial development. Which activity is from Miami? Which activity area is there? For 3,000 square metres?
That is AA4, which is the area in front of the concert site. That's consistent with 3,000 square metres of commercial activity. And the proposal was actually to reduce that to 2,500 square metres.
Of building coverage?
Correct.
Are they limited to a single floor?
It would be in the building because it's 5.5 metre height restriction. And that is certainly the intent.
And is there any limit on what sort of commercial activity there is?
There's two commercial activity provisions. In terms of the AA4, it's commercial and retail activities, so there's no specific restriction on those types of commercial activities. Within AA1 and AA2, the amended provisions that we put forward were commercial activities, ancillaries and winery and viticultural activities, which is reflected in part in some of the policies within the Gibson character zone as well as the existing commercial activity rule within the zone.
Just looking at your proposed rule 23.418, the matter of discretion nature of the activity.
Sorry, so
23.418. Do you envisage the council's discretion as being restricted to in the same nature of the activity? Is that the type of commercial activity?
AA 23.418, the scale nature of activity?
Yes, 17.
Yeah, that's,
well, 17 has the same thing, but that's more confined. But here it's unconfined, but council has the discretion, isn't that? Just asking for arguments.
Potentially. It was more to give certainty that if someone tried to put a supermarket over 2,500 square metres of space, that there'd be almost like a catch point where the council would say, well, it's restricted discretionary, they can look at affected parties, they can look at notification. They could require additional parking and access assessment. It's really to say, well, that's not appropriate for the site and for the hotel, and they can't do that process. I do agree with you, it probably is a little bit open-ended if the council's intent and evaluating the application was they didn't want any commercial activity there, it could be construed to the negative, I believe.
But it's an upper limit anyway, so... it's an upper limit, so if the nature of the activity that ended up being there was not viticulture or wine, it was something else altogether, then that would be just less, because the core wine business would fit in there.
Yes, all correct. You know your maximum 2,500 units, so you are constrained by the area.
So if you put in a supermarket, then a small supermarket, then there'd be nothing there.
Correct.
That's how it works.
And if you exceed any of that, those requirements is not compliant under the actual rule, which is the very first section of Table 1, the existing rule within the Gibson character zone, which is 23.4.1, will say any activity not listed in Tables 1 to 3 is not compliant. So basically, an activity is not clearly outlined within the rule framework, it automatically is not compliant.
Thank you. I'm still wondering why, with no assessment criteria, you're saying that the nature of the activity in the AA4 has discretion. What to stop someone putting in a data centre? Commercial activity.
Correct.
2,500 square metres.
And the rule framework someone could apply for that. Again, it would have to be within the court by restricted discretion activity building requirements as well. So we have to building aspect, we have to
look pretty.
Yeah, we have to look rural and look at that context in terms
of activity. But that's not the point. You're saying that a commercial activity of any sort can go in there, and then you're saying the discretion is limited to the sort of commercial activity without giving any guidance to decision makers as to what sort of commercial activity is appropriate there. That seems to me almost more loose than the definition of commercial recreation.
I think in looking at that and evaluating in more detail, I don't think it would be overly difficult to try and pin down some activities that would be appropriate, because they would need to be, given that activity areas of A1 and A2 provide for commercial activities and sort of wider vertical activity, it would be a case of trying to pin down what commercial activities and retail sales within that area within the confines of 2,500 square metres are appropriate. So I can understand your concern, unless that matters pinned down a little further. But just from my understanding, talking through Mr. Hunt in particular, my understanding of the Gibson character zone, Gibson itself, I couldn't envision anyone realistically coming in out of the left field and doing such an activity. But again, that's not restricted under this rule framework, so I can see the issue.
We're talking probably 20 years later for the proposed plan, and the form of development went ahead, there'd be quite a population there,
yep.
And the land would go out of Gibson Valley Station's ownership, presumably, and then all sorts of people might want to do all sorts of things, and how can the council be guided as to what is appropriate and what isn't?
One of the ways we could have addressed that would be to, rather than having provision of activities right now, unless you turn down the team and just have exclusions, such as I can see, like say a large scale 2,500 square metre office facility for argument's sake, would arguably be not something that would be initially anticipated within this area, so it wouldn't be a hard one to have exclusions for office type activities.
Well, this could go on forever. If you're starting to do it on that basis.
The other flip side is to
pretty good
Well, I'm happy to worry Mr. Hunt with that problem as well. You've got time to think of some answers before we get to Mr. Hunt.
My position hasn't changed from the original consent, which means total certainty as to the outcome.
In fact, one could ask why you simply don't apply the same restriction as you've got for AA 1 and 2. The root of that is.
That could be the answer.
I mean, that's not that. And itself is a little bit secondary argument, but that's the one ancillary means, but at least it's something.
Well, the ancillary
to
wire and verticultural activity is not too far similar to what's in the paper. It's just the fact that there's controls on where for those types of activities before it goes into the non-compliant threshold. And again, when you look, I guess, back at the objects and policies of the zone as well, it does provide for commercial activities that are ancillary to the culture and those types of activities.
I'm thinking, for example, of some of the so-called rural shops which have cropped up in a few places around that I'm aware of. There's one south of Dunedin, very large. There's one south of Ashburton, where almost anything seems to be refilled. I sort of wonder why or why anybody would go there, but they do. Just getting back so I can understand the rural workers' accommodation again, and it comes up in your 836. And Mr. Hunt's no doubt listening, but are we talking about permanent accommodation for the picking operation for a few weeks of the year?
That's probably better for Mr. Hunt to clarify in that regard. But in terms of how the rule framework works, it provides for permanent workers accommodation or temporary workers accommodation. District plan is not extremely helpful in terms of what workers accommodation is either.
Unfortunately,
the definition. And if you actually look at the...
Then it's a well publicised problem in Queenstown at the moment, so I was wondering whether this was done. This was something that had just been provided with a view to the wider market.
Oh, in terms of how this workers' accommodation could provide in the wider market?
Yeah.
Well, there's no restriction on that workers' accommodation being specific to Epsom Station. And if you look at my... my 23.4.19, which is on page 23-9,
that reasons for the appendix. Can you give me
that number again, 23.4.19. It's on the appendix A, I'll just provide my summary. Where it last called that needs to ensure the short handle long term accommodation for workers is the primary activity in AAA. And it was really put there as another step forward to ensure that one that's got workers accommodation and that one that is a mechanism there to try and make that clear as part of the consenting process as well as the problem.
That's a sort of a new condition that you envision could be to give effect to that. What's the wording of a condition that you consider would be applied to a consent to give effect to that?
If Gibson Valley Station granted its safe applied for a consent for 90 rooms over a series of buildings and it may be a temporary structure for argument's sake, there may be a consent condition there saying that that's for short term vertical fitters. Accommodation. If it's a permanent building for argument's sake, just put there, the aesthetics on building would be much greater, which is a restricted discretionary consent for the building itself. So it's really just defined in use, and it could even have a condition there that requires it works accommodation for a certain business as well. And it's just because around that issue that we don't have a definition of workers accommodation. It's another anomaly because it's actually approved from the policies for the zone and the policies for the Epsom character zone, but again there's no possession of Woolsey within the Hitchin and Character Zone that provides for workers' accommodation, and quite practically it's been dealt with as a residential activity in most cases.
Even if it was being used reasonably costly for workers who weren't involved in the activities that give some value, does it matter? What are the effects?
Yeah,
I agree. I mean, I'm aware, for example, that Wedderburn is a huge Sirius corpus, which is used not only by the station itself, but by other stations all about, but in between they use it. It's used for, because it's on the Otago rail trail, of course they open it up the rest of the year for cyclists, and is it a problem?
Not necessarily, I don't believe so. I think when we crafted this rule framework in particular, we looked at it as an integrated planning exercise for Epsom Valley Station and for the resort development. So I guess the connotations with the control have been in that wider context of having four Epsom Valley Station without necessarily restricting four Epsom Valley Station.
The workers' accommodation was provided for workers that weren't working at Epsom Valley Station. Wouldn't that have cracking effects more than if they were?
I think it depends, because for argument's sake, if the workers were all based in AA2, they would still need to access the state highway. Just as the fact is how far
we're talking about one and AA8. We're talking about the one in AA8. If, for instance, they were all ski area workers, there's nothing in there that says they couldn't, NZ Ski could use that for the ski season for 90 of their workers.
Correct.
Would that have different traffic effects than if it were the workers who were purely working on the Gibson Valley Station?
It might be a better question for Mr. Carr, but but my understanding, especially if you use the NZ Ski as an example, they often use buses because I've had staff based in Cromwell for the last, the prior seasons, and buses are going out. So from my lay traffic perspective, I've thought traffic gets worse and less. And rather than having someone on site, again, I think it's a fair for Mr. Carr to answer.
I'll
have
to go in your evidence in terms of paragraph 8.21, you're talking about heritage values, and you say, I recommend that heritage values be included as a measure of control and discretion for new built form and activities within the defined activity area. Can you just walk me through appendix K and show me where that comes up? Okay. There's 23.4.12, were there any others? Archaeological evidence rather than buildings or other kinds of historic heritage?
Yes, that's correct. There are some cottages on site as well, which obviously are archaeological stuff, building heritage.
So just as a small point, perhaps separate ecological from heritage and historic heritage so that we get the more like that. But thanks for that explanation.
And is there no concern in 8A3, 8A4 and 8A5 with respect to those matters?
From my understanding of the archaeological book, that's the case.
No, just so what, remind me again, what were we doing about height?
Building height?
Yes, it's all in, I think it's ages.
Yep, so if you refer to
23 as 3. Yes,
23.3. So in the Gibson character zone, there's a standard maximum height of 8 metres throughout the whole zone.
Of what?
8 metres. And that's on the top of that, that rule. So what's transpired through this process is that we've placed additional controls on each respective activity area where the landscape evidence has found that there should be a reduction of height to reduce the use of prominence. And I think the only one that doesn't have a specific reduction is AA1, which is the Gibson Valley Winery area, which there's been a consent approved there for a lodge structure, I think that's 11 metres high, right in the state, which is non-compliant, but approved nonetheless.
And I think Mr. Parker said that Dr. Reid was happy with his height limits now.
Yes, correct. So this, what you've got in this appendix A, there's no changes from what's been provided previously, just the fact that I've put the one document
that's
easy to read.
I just need to better understand the disagreement between Mr. Baxter and yourself about density and site coverage. So what was
the chances where we got to with that?
Yeah.
So I don't think we did agree. Density and site coverage for a starting point. What I guess we would transpire from the original submission through the meetings with the council, meetings with Mr. Baxter and Dr. Reid on site, was that the council wanted more certainty on what activity is going where, what the site coverage and density requirements were, to get a clearer picture of what's actually going to be proposed. So if you refer to rule 23.5.9, yes. That's the rule relating to this on page 23.13. That is the maximum building coverages within each respective area of the Kirsten Valley subzone activity areas. Those standards are permitted, and if they are breached, they are non-compliant, is the way that rules are written. So that's the basic site coverage expectation. And if you look at those provisions, where it relates to buildings and visitor accommodation, it's being set aside into a specific area. And then if you look at the next rule, which is, if you look at 23.5.11, and it refers to the number of units of visitor accommodation units within a period. So between that, you can then work out the density
of... and you say that, well, Mr. Parker said that Mr. Buxton got that completely wrong, because what that table doesn't do is tell you how big those activity areas are. So that,
how
many years so it was the question of ratio, not the maximum sizes, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in terms of if they are going to say AA3 is 7 hectares and this equates to 1 hectare of building coverage,
yes,
those ratios, actually Mr. Milne might be able to help clarify that matter, but I understand that the table that forms part of the structure plan actually has those ratios on it, but that would be for guidance.
Okay.
So you can see there is the respective, in the last column, it has census of site coverage per activity area. So just don't lose context that that's per activity area. It's not, doesn't take into account the productive landscape areas or any areas of open space as well.
Say that again, sorry.
So no areas of
open
space. So this column here of the structure plan. So if you look at A83, for example, that's 7.08 hectares and building coverage maximum is 1.75 hectares.
Mm.
So that equates to a 25% site coverage for that activity area.
Yeah.
And that doesn't include, when you look at 25%, doesn't include any of these other productive landscape areas which are very close to us.
So the productive landscape areas are not activity areas?
Correct. If you look back at the prior rules, we had a 10% site coverage requirement over the entire site. And I think that's where Mr. Buxton and I, they differ, but Mr. Buxton's calculations were looking at 10% across the whole site and working back what that was going to relate to. So this rendition of the new rules basically takes it probably 3 or 4 steps further by actually identifying coverages within the series.
So, are you saying that if it was built up to the maximum that those rules allow for, we'd be ending up with about 10% over the whole site?
No, I think it's much less than that.
4.12, I think, is the calculation in the legal submission. 4.12%.
I think we've sort of rounded it up to 5 from time to time, but yes, 4.2 I think is correct.
And Mr. Buxton's misunderstood that in some way.
I think so. I think it was no criticism of Mr. Buxton, but it was based on the evidence sheet. So we had clarified that.
Okay.
Just on that rule, why do we need to have some specific definition of building coverage? What's wrong with the proposed definition?
We are going to step down a little bit to how we can address Mr. Buxton's concerns. That was often raised in a certain identity. One of the things I looked at was being done in the Bilbrook Resort Zone, Waterfall Park. I looked at Rural Residential Zone as well, and I recall that additional text was from the Bilbrook Resort Zone provisions in regard to density, and it was really there for a clarity purposes and part of the rule framework, but I don't have any concerns with that was removed and relied on the definition. I thought it was useful for clarification.
Well, the definition of building coverage excludes all those things anyway. Well, it doesn't include them.
That's correct.
It's not just that, isn't it, Mr. Chair? It's not conventional to put definition inside a rule. A rule should give effect to the word. The word should be defined in the definition. But cleaner in the plan that we just use it once.
No problems in my side of deleting that.
I've got another one. I've got a very general one, so people have finished with the rules. One of the things said in both legal submissions and in your agents is that subzone will build better management of the land than a series of resource consents. I would like to know whether or not that is actually true, because the resource consents will follow from this subzone too. So how much better and more efficient is the subzone than continuing with the existing zone and just getting consent?
Good question. Well,
especially when most of them aren't implemented as far as I can tell, and I know why.
And that comparison table that Mr. Parker put forward at the start, that actually that property actually shows it quite well. If you look from 1994 through to 2016, there's been a series of consents that have been proposed there. This has all been under a discretionary tax regime. Mm. So, as a snapshot, I'll probably gather that probably at least three or four of these resource consents have been notified to the public. And because of that existing discretionary tax regime, that there's very limited certainty as to what you can and can't do with the zone. I shouldn't say overly limited, but it does impose, in my experience, and again with a lot of consents in this zone, the general expectation that the council notifies consents for development, especially built form. So the intent of this zone framework is really to recognise that there is a large level of development approved in the area. It's been traversed by Nick Sneddon, Tony Milne, Dr. Reed, in terms of those built form impacts, and then look at it, how it can actually provide for that in a broad framework that still requires consent, but consent that will be hopefully put through a process that has a higher level of certainty rather than a discretionary regime which comes with much less certainty.
I'll put it to you another way then, which is what I think I need to say. After something like 20 years, has your phone been in place for 20 years?
It's been gone.
A number of consents have been granted and the shape of the zone is firming up. And having a sub-zone just puts a new marker for the baseline.
Yeah, correct. It's not creating a new one, but it's setting an expectation within a certain area of the Gippsland character zone that a certain level of development is anticipated, which is set out in the density and the numbers of units and perimeters. And then outside of that, you still retain the discretionary regime. And that's the recognising, again, it's probably better for Mr. Milne to touch on some more detail, but the recognising the land fact that this is a specific area of the site and what's been consented as well.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the answer is that that if the panel agrees to the sub-zone, there will still continue to be consent, but they'll be assessed against a different, a modified.
Correct.
In paragraphs 8.30 to 8.32, you talk about reverse sensitivity. I'm not quite sure how you come to the conclusion that it can be self-regulating. Isn't the proposal to subdivide off sites? So how is it going to be self-regulating?
It actually ended up being Mr. Hunt might be able to clarify, but in our discussions, because Gippsland Valley Station is essentially the one owner of this land, they can put mechanisms on covenants and the like, so if that is subdivided off or put into separation, that they can impose those controls. If this was, say for example, further down the valley where there's multiple ownership and more smaller lots within larger parcels, there would be a higher risk of reverse sensitivity if this proposal was postponed. But because that one ownership and the ability for Gippsland Valley Station to impose controls, I think that knocks that down on the heap as well.
Would it be perhaps better prop that Gippsland Valley is prepared to accept that situation and attempt to deal with it?
Probably would be helpful just to maybe if I added a comment there about your tools that can be put in place to help manage that.
Would it be wise, if that was the case, that the district plan, if we were to accept your
proposal should clearly state somewhere that reverse sensitivity is not an issue the council may deal with in this respect. Final point. The Tararua River has a water conservation order on it.
Yeah.
Have you, in anywhere in the Section 32 evaluation room or evidence, given consideration to the effects on the purposes of that conservation order?
No, I haven't. I will touch on that point, just about that further from the questions that were written just asked before. I probably had to guess I'm the only person in the room that had the benefit of going down that river in a raft, specifically looking at buildings. If you refer to the 2008 Gibson Valley Centre, it refers to the, what they call the Hunter Building Platform, which is the, you can see the bar over the structure plane, where the productive landscape area is, and then just in the last spring along, the building platform approved back there, and as part of that, process that visibility from the river was flagged as an issue. So we had to go down that river with the landscape architect twice, trying to propose, trying to ascertain the level of visibility. And where that transpires into this proposal is that the area of Aotearoa. The prior structure plan had AA2 around the top, and that was one of the mechanisms that was reducing that area to make sure that the visibility would be afforded. And it's quite a significant area that's been pulled back. So in terms of that water conservation order, it has been a long time since I've looked at it. But from my understanding, based on what's been proposed now, I'd be quite confident that it wouldn't have any significant impact on that at all.
Well, on the visibility aspect.
So I'll call up Ms. Herbert now, if I may.
Valley Wines. I've been in this position since 2006, December 2006. I have a Bachelor of Agricultural Science measuring in Enology from the University of Adelaide in Australia. Evidence was provided by our chief winemaker, Mr. King, which is in the standing evidence, in regard to the proposal for Mixed Valley Station. I have read his evidence in chief, dated the 12th of June 2017, and I confirm that I agree with his comments and findings. I've also reviewed the proposed structure plan that identifies the areas shown for productive planting, which I understand is a viticultural or agricultural planting. I'm very familiar with these areas of the station, and I agree with Mr. Key in his paragraph 3.14 that these are the areas of the station that are suitable for viticulture. Mr. King and I have discussed at length our current and future rosé and mezzo traditional wine production demands, and I absolutely agree with Mr. Keyes in the requirement for a cool climate fruit suitable for these wine styles from the Gibson sub-region. Gibson possesses a complex array of grape growing sites, ranging from very good to very unsuitable. I agree with Mr. Keyes that the area shown for development on the north side of the highway, AA2 and AA5, would be unsuitable for vines. I have been advised that the area of planting near AA3 relates to a requirement in a resource consent approved to Gibson Valley Station. Gibson Valley Wine is proposing to install the infrastructure for the vineyard planting in preparation for the planting of the grapes next year, spring 2018.
I think in the last paragraph you may have answered the only question I had of Mr. King.
Oh, let's do it though, I
want
to ask question.
Well, throughout Mr. King's evidence, he talks about areas being suitable for viticultural planting.
Mm-hmm.
And is there anything in the district plan that stops Gibson Valley planting those suitable areas at present?
Gosh, that's a question for those of you who've read a lot of literature. You know, that's beyond my...
I thought that was not.
Is it?
Is there any questions? No. Thank you, Ms. Herbert.
Okay, the wine's delicious. Okay.
Okay. So I'm not quite sure about your convention from what you see. I was going to go into Mr. Hill.
It's not even 30, so we can probably...
We can commence.
Yes.
What you had in front of you is a summary of evidence that I've written. accompanying that is an A3 graphic attachment. And included in that graphic attachment are two plans showing five photo viewpoints. And from those viewpoints, the office of Ruffin Mill, and specifically Jury in London, has prepared video simulations or photo simulations. They are contained there as A3 prints. They're also pinned up on the wall there. The blue face to the wall is A2. On the top of those photo simulation pages, there is a before shot, and underneath it is an after simulation of what the subzone will look like. Also, as has been reversed at length by Mr. Gibbs, rather than two extended A1 planes on the wall map, and one showing the structural plan, proposed structural plan, and the master plan of the continued development of 2008. And if I, before I start reading this, if I can just clarify, I am not Nick Eastman. I am Tony Mann, and Nick had prepared the evidence in chief, or Mr. Mann had prepared the evidence in chief along with myself. It was a resource issue in the office at the time. I'm appearing here today to present and answer questions to that evidence. I'll start with number two there in my evidence summary. The proposed Gibson Valley subzone will enable a broader approach to rural activities and support other non-rural activities and locations that are considered appropriate, while maintaining the presence of this cultural activity in Gibson. The appropriateness of activities, the absorption capacity of the landscape, and the effects of the proposed subzone development are determined by identifying whether the landscape character of the Gibson Valley will be maintained. The Gibson character zone places a strong emphasis on difficulty to maintain the character. More particularly, there is an emphasis on a productive regime to maintain the character values attributed to this particular landscape. These productive activities contribute to a rural character, but are not its sole determinant. Ancillary activities such as residential dwellings and the Gibson Valley River Trail also contribute to the existing Gibson Valley character. The landscape is currently in a state of change as a range of tourism and recreational activities are gradually replacing traditional farming activities. This is reflected by the extent of consented and as yet unrealised development, particularly that consented for Gibson Valley Station. The consent history covers a range of activities including wineries, residential activities, large-scale commercial development and civil development. Recreational activities including the heating of golf course and the Gibson Valley River Trail. The consented development forms part of the receiving environment into which the proposed subzone sits. The proposed subzone enables the development outlined by the structure plan, which identifies the location of activity areas 1 to 6 and 8 proposed for development. The structure plan and subzone is a carefully considered comprehensive proposal that includes the consented development and provides for some additional tight clusters of development in areas of lower productive value with a significant area of open space retaining suitable for productive life. The retention of openness was an important consideration in the structure plan design, avoiding a sprawl of conspicuous development along State Highway 6 while maintaining a consistency with the intention and focus of the overall zone. The existing receiving environment over the valley floor consists of the established Gibson Valley Winery fronting State Highway 6, large open areas of pasture with several existing clusters of buildings surrounded by rural amenity trees visible south of State Highway 6. Consented development essentially extends these building clusters, introducing large-scale buildings as part of the Vintners Village and two additional clusters of small-scale buildings north of State Highway 6. The intensive planting proposed as part of the consented development and the structure plan will inevitably change the existing character of the site and outlook from the hollow. The existing proposed increase in vineyards and other productive plantings will be the dominant feature of the road corridor. The structure plan locates activity areas and locations that have the potential to absorb change, i.e. avoiding skylines, ridges, hills and prominent slopes. rocky outcrops remain talented, and views of buildings from the Kawarau River are also avoided. The builders we sighted and grouped fit into the landscape using the existing topography to minimise visual effects and maintain a coherency with the preceding environment. Natural science, ecological and archaeological values are acknowledged and maintained on the site with the ability to be experienced by the public. Further refinements have been made to the structure plan, ensuring separation between building clusters and the AA ceiling open space referred to in the primary release is now removed. The maximum height limits for consented development within AA3 and AA6 have been reduced from 7 metres to 5.5 metres. We'll now address landscape matters raised by Dr. Reed. In her rebuttal evidence, Dr. Reed refers to the amended structure plan and subzone provisions and indicate that the initial reservations have been addressed from a landscape perspective. Dr. Reed and I are in full agreement. Now, if I just clarify that, Dr. Reed, and has been alluded to today, Dr. Reed has since provided a summary from her rebuttal, and I'm referring to agreeing with her on that. I have read the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Buckley, and also a few issues he raises over density and site covers. I acknowledge Mr. Giddens in this summary of evidence addresses these comments as well. From a landscape character outcome, I find it difficult to reconcile Mr. Buxton's position in regard to Dr. Reed. The policy framework relevant to landscape effects arising from the proposed subzone are found in the proposed district plan in Chapter 3, Chapter 6, and Chapter 23. I am satisfied that the subzone will meet the objectives and policies anticipated by Chapter 3 and 6. Chapter 23 contains detailed provisions relating to Gibson Character Zone. The purpose of this zone is to provide primarily for viticulture and commercial activities with an affiliation to the viticulture within the Gibson Valley. Objective 1 and policies seek to protect the economic viability, character and landscape values of the character zone by enabling viticulture activities and controlling adverse effects resulting from inappropriate activities located in the zone. From a landscape character and visual amenity perspective, the proposed subzone objective and policies appropriately reflects the evolution of developments within the existing character zone and others. In summary, the subzone will satisfy the relevant character zone objectives and policies by activity areas that are appropriately located to ensure potential productive land is maximised and character is maintained. Activity areas which provide for a range of building, ancillary to agriculture and worker accommodation. Providing a mechanism to comprehensively plan for development in areas with potential to absorb challenge. Allowing for the establishment of activities that contribute to the character and viability of the character zone in a comprehensive manner. And recognising the importance of nature, conservation and ecosystems by proposing an integrated, sustainable approach to the development and protection of natural values, including archaeological and heritage values. The proposed subzone enables appropriate development to occur within the Gibson Character Zone, achieving a greater certainty of outcome while protecting and maintaining the landscape values pertaining to the zone. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the morning adjournment now before we ask any questions. And so we'll adjourn until 11:15.